This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
This guideline shows that MAB114 and Regeneron EB3 reduced mortality. The relative risk reduction was about 60%.
That's Janet Diaz with the World Health Organization talking about two new treatments for Ebola. Details coming up. Also, today is World Humanitarian Day, a day set aside to honor aid workers all over the world. We have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Next Wednesday, Angola holds parliamentary elections, which will lead to the selection of the country's next president. How are preparations going on so far? How is the mood in the country? These are some of the questions I asked Mayra Fernandez with VOA's Portuguese to Africa service, who is in Angola's capital, Luanda, covering the election.
Yeah, yes, thank you so much for having me. I've been here in Luanda, it has been 5 days. We are actually 5 days away from the election date, August 24th. And the environment is it's a bit tense. There's some nervousness around among voters. People are very anxious because they believe this election is different, feels different. The people that I talked with, they say we have to remember that for the first time, two main parties running are really close. You know, the popularity that the opposition leader from UNITA, Adalberto Costa Jr., has, especially among the youth, it's big. Most of the people that are going to vote this year, they are between 18 and 24 year old. Actually, a lot of people that I talked with, civil society, analysts, observers, they say that... the change is already happening because we are seeing an engagement that we haven't seen before.
You're talking about the majority of the populace that will be voting are, you said, between the ages of 18 and 24. Will that actually favor UNITA's charismatic leader, Adalberto Costa Jr., who is drawing massive crowds at his political rallies?
I would say so. If we just look at the facts, we don't know exactly what's going to happen now. I mean, we don't really know what's going to happen when people get to the ballots, right? And maybe they'll change their minds. But there's two things that we need to look at on this process that people have been highlighting for me. One is that these people that we are talking about, these young people, they have no memory of war because they never lived it. So the rhetoric of UNITA, that was once the guerrilla movement, doesn't resonate with these people. So what they are looking at is someone that they feel that understands their needs. João Lourenço, in 2017, he ran on several issues, and one of them was creating employment. And unemployment among the youth is the biggest in Angola. So when he said that he would create this 500,000 job, people halfway his mandate were asking, where are those jobs?
Okay, so we have João Lourenço, the handpicked predecessor of José Eduardo dos Santos, the former president, who recently died in Spain, by the way. And we have Adalberto Costa Jr., who is the charismatic leader you just talked about. But one other interesting fact is we have a woman candidate in 30 years for the first time running for the presidency. Can you talk a little about her? Who is she?
Florbela Malaquias. Florbela Malaquias, or simply Bela Malaquias, she is a lawyer. She was also a journalist. She created this party now that is the Humanista Party, so focus on the human being. And she's running on the slogan that Mama has come, hunger is gone. Mm. So she promises to end hunger in Angola, which we know has been more and more a big, big issue, not just because of economic reasons, but also climate change has been affecting, especially in the south. The communities in the south are suffering a lot, 7 years. And this is her slogan, is that she's going to end hunger. It's curious that the first woman that ran was in 1992. There was the first elections that Angola held, and it took 30 years, even though Angola only had 5 electoral processes so far, for someone else to come. But also, it's not only this woman running, but there's also a big list of women running for parliament and very young women.
That was Mayra Fernandes with VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. She talked to me from Angola's capital, Luanda. The World Health Organization says clinical evidence shows two monoclonal antibody treatments are effective at saving the lives of many people stricken with the deadly Ebola virus. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Health Agency issued new recommendations Friday for the use of monoclonal antibody treatments for Ebola. The action follows a systematic review and analysis of randomized clinical trials of therapeutics for the disease. WHO team leader for clinical care, Janet Diaz, says the evidence underpinning the recommendations comes from two clinical trials. The largest was done in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2018 and 2019. She says the trials were conducted during Ebola outbreaks, demonstrating quality control trials can be done even under the most difficult circumstances.
The evidence synthesis that informs this guideline shows that MAB114 and Regeneron EB3 reduced mortality. The relative risk reduction was about 60%, between 230 to 400 lives saved per 1,000 patients. Translate that into number needed to treat. You treat 2 to 4 patients and you save one life.
Ebola hemorrhagic fever is spread through blood or body fluids of a person who is sick with or has died of the disease. The worst Ebola outbreak occurred in West Africa between 2014 and 2016. Of the nearly 29,000 reported cases, more than 11,300 people died. Diaz calls the development of monoclonal antibody therapeutics a very important advancement. However, she notes the drug itself is not the only solution. She says it must be given in a comprehensive clinical setting along with other treatments.
That includes early diagnosis so that treatments can be given as soon as possible, and also the implementation of appropriate infection prevention and control to stop transmission and treatment of co-infections, and access to nutrition, psychosocial support, and of course, access to care after discharge.
Diaz says the two recommended therapeutics have shown clear benefits for people of all ages. She says they can be used on all patients confirmed positive for Ebola virus disease. That, she says, includes older people, pregnant and breastfeeding women, children, and babies born to mothers with confirmed Ebola within the first 7 days after birth. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenya's former minister, Raila Odinga, is challenging the validity of the results of a closely fought election that saw his rival William Ruto declared president-elect. As the battle moves to Kenya's Supreme Court, political and legal experts weigh in on Odinga's claims of voter fraud. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
Ruto William Samoei has been duly elected as the president.
In the wake of Kenyan elections, current Deputy President William Ruto was declared president-elect after earning 50.5% of the votes. But his main rival, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, who received 48.9% of the votes, has refused to concede. The fight now shifts to the country's highest court, where Odinga and his Azimio la Umoja One Kenya coalition hope to overturn the results. Odinga is alleging voter fraud and legal experts say the court will be looking at the evidence. Ishmael Nyaribo is a constitutional lawyer in Nairobi.
You must appreciate that to subvert or sabotage the will of the people is both criminal and borders on treason. It is extremely serious. But that is just what is being said on media.
Joy Mudivo, an election law expert and a former magistrate, agrees.
There must be tangible or material discrepancy. The same must be proved satisfactorily, and it must be demonstrated that it would have changed the outcome of the case. If those three ingredients do not line up, then you are unlikely to be successful.
Four of the seven election commissioners, all of them appointed by Odinga ally President Uhuru Kenyatta, have disowned the presidential results by the commission's chairperson, Wafula Chebukati. Lawyers say that will provide impetus to a petition challenging the outcome, even as local observers under the umbrella of the Elections Observation Group give the poll a clean bill of health. Mule Musau is the national coordinator of the Elections Observation Group, an umbrella of election observers in Kenya.
We have not seen anything that would warrant a petition of this nature. However, we remain open to the fact that there could be something.
The Kenyan constitution allows anyone to challenge the presidential election outcome at the Supreme Court within 7 days of the announcement of the results. Such a petition will be heard and a verdict issued within 14 days of filing. If the Supreme Court upholds the outcome, the new president is sworn in on the 7th day after the verdict. If the election is nullified, a repeat election is conducted within 60 days after the verdict. Kenyans' views vary about Odinga's decision to challenge the election outcome. Wilson Kanyingi is a resident of Nyandarua County.
A lot of irregularities and irregularities. Yeah, so we go back to election or we recount it.
Stanley Mahaya is a resident of the capital, Nairobi.
We are urging the court this time to give justice. And justice, we mean if somebody won the election, just give him his victory. Don't tell us again to go back to elections, because this will be now.
Kenya has been lauded for conducting a fairly peaceful election so far. As the battle over the validity of the results move to the highest court, Kenyans are hopeful that peace will prevail. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Today is World Humanitarian Day, a day set aside to honor aid workers all over the world and to pay tribute to those who have died or been injured in their efforts to help those in need. The United Nations says that over the past year, 141 aid workers died around the world doing their jobs. Most of them were from the countries in which they died. Hundreds more have been attacked. In South Sudan, Sara Nianti, the United Nations humanitarian coordinator, says so far this year, 5 aid workers have been killed, all of them South Sudanese. She implored the government and the armed groups that control some communities in the country to protect those who are providing essential aid to millions of South Sudanese. You're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. The disputed Ethiopian area of Western Tigray is expected to be sticking point in the country's peace talks aimed at ending a nearly 2-year civil war. Forces allied with the federal government took control of the area, but Tigrayan forces say it must be returned for talks to move forward. Henry Wilkins gained rare access to the region recently and looks at why both sides are refusing to back down in this report from Adi Ramat, Ethiopia.
The disputed region of Western Tigray, local officials led VOA into the hills close to the town of Adi Ramat. Here is what they claim was the site of a concentration camp run by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF, in the late 1980s and early 1990s. One witness, Cheru Gebremariam, says he was held in a cave along with many other Amharas, people that the TPLF persecuted because of their ethnicity decades ago. He says he has known this place since the 80s and was detained here for a year and 7 months with his friend. We stayed here in the cave during daylight hours to avoid air raids, he says. The history of Western Tigray, or Welkayet, as the Amhara regional government refers to it, is complex. Amhara forces wrestled control of Western Tigray from the TPLF during the current conflict that began in November 2020, claiming the TPLF wrongly annexed the region in the early 90s and that, historically, the region has always belonged to them. They urged the government to make it a legal part of Amhara. As peace talks to put an end to Ethiopia's nearly two-year civil war look more likely, both the Amhara and Tigray regional leadership are demanding control of the area. Analysts say the disputes will play a crucial role in negotiations. William Davidson is an analyst at the International Crisis Group, a Belgian-based research group.
This is what we describe as a zero-sum dispute at Crisis Group, and this is why it's such a hard problem to resolve. I think we can all come up with sort of potential compromise solutions, joint administration, local autonomy, federal administration, but simply getting to the stage where that sort of compromise political arrangement is accepted by the two regions is hard to conceive of at the moment.
Experts say any historical claim by the Amhara is irrelevant, since Ethiopia's constitution states Western Tigray is part of the Tigray region. Geographer Jan Nyssen teaches at Belgium's Ghent University.
Ethiopian constitution doesn't allow for that historical claim. Yeah, because this is endless, because you change. I've seen these maps through time. Every 50 years, these borders were changing. Yeah, so what historical claim are you going to look at? What are you going to consider?
In the cave VOA visited, researchers from the University of Gondar could be seen pulling bones out of the ground they claim belong to prisoners killed at the camp during TPLF rule. Many ethnic Amharas, they say, believe such alleged evidence of past atrocities shows why the region should be under their control. But the Amhara region-based university's research into the graves has been criticised by experts. Critics say the federal government has used the graves as propaganda and questions the timing of old graves coinciding with new allegations of ethnic cleansing committed against Tigrayans during the current war. Independent researchers have not been given access to the sites. Hune Mandefro, a former researcher now working at the Amhara Association of America, a non-profit documenting abuse against ethnic Amharas, admitted the university has yet to use forensic techniques to piece together what's happened at the grave sites.
I'm hopeful that this will happen in the future, but at this point, it's just mapping the mass graves where they're located.
Since the Amhara occupied Western Tigray in early 2021, rights groups such as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International say Tigrayans are being attacked and forcibly removed from the region. A TPLF spokesperson declined to comment on how the fate of Western Tigray could factor into peace talks. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Adi Rametz, Ethiopia.
The UN World Food Programme, WFP, says nearly half of the population of Ethiopia's Tigray region needs food aid. The WFP says a lack of fuel to transport supplies makes the problem worse. It estimates that about 13 million people in Tigray and the neighboring regions of Afar and Amhara are suffering from food shortages, an increase of 44% since January. The WFP says rates of hunger and malnutrition have skyrocketed. It says about half of pregnant or lactating women in Tigray are malnourished, and a third of the children under five, which could lead to stunting and maternal death. The federal administration in Addis Ababa says it is willing to enter into talks with Tigray. However, Tigray's government says it first wants a restoration of services to civilians, including banking and communication services. renowned Somali author and poet Muhammad Ibrahim Warsem, better known by his pen name as Hadrawi, died Thursday in the Somaliland capital Hargeisa. He was 79. Widely regarded as the greatest living Somali poet and called the Shakespeare of Somalia, Warsem had battled illness for years. After Warsame's family announced his death, Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud expressed the country's sorrow, saying the poet was an icon who would be remembered for his role in peace building.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, despite all the modern tools we have at our disposal, we're experiencing the worst global food security crisis I have ever seen, said U.S. Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield. In Africa, one out of every five people is undernourished, one in five.
Food insecurity means families are not able to provide for their children. It means children not getting the nutrition they need to succeed at school. And in the worst cases, it means famine, and famine means death.
That's why we have to be determined to stamp out hunger. To do that, she said, we must look at what is driving food insecurity in the first place.
I see four clear causes, what I call the E and the three C's: energy, climate, COVID, and conflict.
Energy prices have gone up in the past year. And because energy is indispensable in food production, high energy prices mean more expensive food. The first C stands for climate change.
The climate crisis is a crisis of natural disasters, of floods and storms and heat waves, but it also directly leads to food security crisis.
The second C is COVID. COVID-19 gave us an immediate and additional shock to the system, said Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. Before COVID, 100 million people were food insecure. 3 years later, just in 3 years, that number jumped to over 190 million people. Then there is a third C, which I believe is the most insidious source of hunger, said Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. That is hunger caused by conflict, hunger that is caused intentionally, hunger used as a weapon of war. All of these problems, energy, climate, COVID, and conflict, combine into a complex cocktail that has led to the worst hunger crisis of our lifetimes, said Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. Finally, because conflicts can weaponize hunger and force people to leave their homes, which puts strains on the food systems of surrounding countries, Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield announced more than $127 million in additional humanitarian assistance to support refugees, asylum seekers, internally displaced persons, stateless persons, and persecuted people across Africa. Now is the moment to work together across governments, across countries, between people to end hunger, she said. Now is the moment to forge partnerships with civil society, the private sector, to galvanize the diaspora, to take advantage of new technologies and better techniques, to build the food systems and the structures of the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Justin Twait, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM stations.